Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. You're listening to an All Sides special. The Supreme Court upholds most of President Obama's Affordable Health Care Act. The Supreme Court has upheld the individual insurance requirement at the heart of President Barack Obama's health care overhaul. In a 5-4 ruling, the court this morning rejected that Congress went too far in requiring most Americans to have health insurance or pay a penalty. We are waiting for remarks by President Obama. When that happens, we'll bring it to you live. We have no idea when it will happen, however. Reaction is starting to come in from Ohio political leaders. Attorney General Mike DeWine says he is disappointed by the Supreme Court's decision. He says in a statement, "The law will again be fought in the political arena and will be the preeminent issue of the presidential campaign." He says, "There is a victory in this case. The Supreme Court did not expand the powers under the Commerce Clause. While I am disappointed in Justice Roberts' decision, he was the leader in restricting the Commerce Clause, an expansion of which would have been detrimental to our country. If that would have been upheld, it would mean there are no limits to what Congress could compel Americans to purchase. While we lost the battle over Obamacare, we did win the war on the true meaning of the Commerce Clause." Ohio, led by DeWine, was one of 26 states to challenge the health care law. We hope to speak to the Ohio Attorney General coming up on this All Sides with Ann Fisher special. Once again, I want to welcome Ruth Kolker, a constitutional law professor at The Ohio State University Moritz College of Law. Ruth, once again, thanks for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Also joining us in the studio now, Peter Shane. He's the Jacob E. Davis and Jacob E. Davis II Chair in Law at The Ohio State University's Moritz College of Law. Welcome to the show, Peter.
Glad to be with you, Ann.
So the Commerce Clause, the comments by Attorney General Mike DeWine that they lost the battle over the Health Care Reform Act, but did win the war on the true meaning of the Commerce Clause. Agree?
It's a very interesting question. I heard my colleague Ruth say before that it was quite surprising that Chief Justice Roberts would say anything about the Commerce Clause, having already decided to uphold the mandate under the taxing power. Ordinarily, as Professor Kolker said, the Supreme Court follows prudential rules of self-restraint that lead the justices not to opine on constitutional issues that are not necessary to their decision. Strictly speaking, Chief Justice Roberts's view of the Commerce Clause is not binding law because it didn't determine the outcome of the case. And there are other cases, again, haven't read the monster of an opinion, but I'm not aware that the court has overturned any of its prior Commerce Clause cases. I think, like many members of the Academy who've looked at this, simply did not agree with the argument that upholding the mandate under the Commerce Clause would abolish any limits at all on Congress's power under the Commerce Clause. So I don't agree with what we just heard Attorney General DeWine saying. But what one can say is we now know what Chief Justice Roberts thinks. We know what the other four conservative members of the court think. If you're litigating in front of the court or if you're thinking about proposing new legislation in Congress, you know that there are five votes that have taken a particular position, and obviously you would want to accommodate that in your thinking.
Ruth, anything to add on that score?
Yeah, it's hard to know whether that I would call sort of spin by Attorney General DeWine is accurate. The court's most recent Commerce Clause decision, United States versus Comstock from 2010, the court voted to uphold a federal law imposing extended confinement on dangerous sexual predators who have completed their criminal sentences. And Breyer wrote a majority opinion that was joined by Chief Justice Roberts, John Paul Stevens, who's no longer on the court, has been replaced by Justice Kagan, Ginsburg and Sotomayor. Kennedy and Alito concurred separately, agreeing with the decision. That's the broadest reading of the Commerce Clause that includes the conservative wing of the court to date. That's from 2010. All those members of the court who are conservative are still on the court. I assume that Chief Justice Roberts' opinion today does not invalidate that decision from 2 years ago that he joined. So I don't know that he's in any way changed our Commerce Clause jurisprudence. The Republicans argued that the health care law was unprecedented. It did more than any other statute has ever done in our nation's history. Well, if that's true, then it's no big deal if they conclude the Commerce Clause was that the Congress exceeded its Commerce Clause authority. Would Congress ever again pass such massive legislation under the Commerce Clause? Well, probably not. So It could be sui generis, you know, oh, yes, this is unconstitutional, but would anything else be unconstitutional? I would go back to United States versus Comstock, the last 7-2 majority opinion by essentially this court for guidance on what is the meaning of the Commerce Clause, not this particular decision today.
Peter Chain?
I would say I would disagree, I think, with Professor Coker on just one detail. As I recall, the majority opinion in Comstock, it rests entirely on the necessary and proper clause and doesn't actually mention what power the law that the court was upholding was necessary and proper to do. So it's not clear that it was a Commerce Clause case. In fact, I found it an utterly puzzling case, except if you believe that there's a rule of law that's, you know, sexual predators always lose in the Supreme Court. So I'm not quite sure, what to make of Comstock. I do think that I believe that, particularly for Kennedy, the specter that lurks over their decision making, the thing, if you wanted an example of what they would really be afraid of, it would be any kind of broad federal mandate with regard to the content of education on the fairly obvious ground that the quality of education influences the volume and promotion of interstate commerce. That's what conservatives don't want to see. And I think whatever principles they're trying to use to delimit congressional action, my guess is that's from their point of view, the nightmare that they're trying to avoid.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher. The Supreme Court has upheld the heart of President Barack Obama's health care overhaul, ruling in favor of the requirement that most Americans can be required to have health insurance or else pay a penalty. The decision means the historic overhaul will continue to take effect over the next several years, affecting the way countless Americans receive and pay for their personal medical care. The ruling also hands President Barack Obama a campaign season victory. The court found problems with the law's expansion of Medicaid, but even there, it said the expansion could proceed as long as the federal government does not threaten to withhold the entire Medicaid allotment to states if they don't take part in the extension. The court's four liberal justices, Stephen Breyer, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, Elena Kagan, and Sonia Sotomayor, joined Roberts in the outcome. Let's turn to that to the expansion of Medicaid. It seems to be the crux of a lot of conversation. It said the expansion could proceed as long as the federal government does not threaten to withhold the entire Medicaid allotment. What do they mean by entire Medicaid allotment? How does that play into this, Ruth Kolker?
Well, the way Medicaid works is that Congress, under its spending power, says to the states, we'll give you certain money. You can take that money if you agree to use that money to provide health insurance to people below a certain poverty level income. And every state right now has agreed to accept Medicaid money and provides health insurance through Medicaid to poor people. States have discretion under Medicaid, exactly how they do that. It's not exactly the same care in every state, but every state has accepted that Medicaid partnership with the federal government. As part of the health care law, the Obama administration wanted to expand the roles as much as possible of who's covered by health insurance. And since, as we've now been heard, the way the individual mandate works is that people who pay taxes are penalized if they don't buy health insurance, those who don't pay taxes or below a certain income level were exempted from that individual mandate requirement. So what the Obama administration proposed was that to increase the number of Americans covered by health insurance, we would say to the states, when you take Medicaid dollars, now we'll give you more Medicaid dollars, but you have to agree to cover a family of four up to income of $32,000 rather than $22,000 roughly. And that will be the new rules about Medicaid. And now, once again, take it or leave it. That's always been the rule. The states argued that because of the large number of people in that income category of $22,000 to $32,000, that it would cause them to greatly, greatly expand their Medicaid rosters, that they don't get 100 cents on the dollar for Medicaid. And they therefore didn't have a genuine ability to say no because they couldn't afford to not cover the very poorest people. They wanted to still cover the very poorest people, but they didn't have any good posture to take with respect to those who earn between $22,000 and $32,000. So what the court has now said is it sort of played Solomon here, I guess, a bit. It said to the states, okay, you're right. It is unduly coercive to have to make this awful choice between covering all these people and incurring a tremendous additional tax bill or to cover nobody. That's not an appropriate choice. So now we're going to rewrite that legislation that Congress passed and say that had Congress known that we thought that violated the spending clause, Congress would have wanted us to retain the entire Medicaid statute and tinker with it by saying that you have a choice whether to opt in or opt out just to that incremental change to go from 22,000 to 32,000. And if you want to, take that money, whatever it is, 30 cents on the dollar, and pay for the rest out of your own dollars, or say no thank you to Congress and don't accept that money, but you still can have the money for those who you were already recovering from zero to 22,000.
So the number of people covered under the new law would just vary from state to state depending on whether or not they accept that.
Right. So this is a defeat for the Obama administration in the sense that their goal was to cover as many Americans as possible. So when we now calculate how many more additional people will be covered as a result of this Affordable Care Act, the number now will be lower than the Obama administration originally projected, because we can predict that many states, maybe the 26 states that joined this challenge, will now turn down those dollars. And maybe even some of the other states that didn't challenge the constitutionality of the statute when faced with that financial decision, we don't know. Maybe they will now choose to also not accept those Medicaid dollars. I have no insight as to what that decision will be. Peter?
Yeah, I think Ruth explained that perfectly. What will be interesting to see, if you took the temperature of, professional Supreme Court watchers, I think a sentence that I heard in a lot of conversations is, well, of course, the Medicaid thing will be upheld. I mean, that actually was regarded as, I think, by a lot of people as a fairly easy win for the government, because the court had been so generous previously in articulating how much power Congress has to bribe, or if you want to say incentivize, the states to participate in federal programs. So one of the things that I would certainly be looking at in reading this opinion would be whether that basic framework of congressional capacity to incentivize the states has been changed in any serious way, or whether, you know, this is a kind of one-time only reading of a particularly burdensome statute that may not have much implications for other federal programs.
You're listening to an All Sides with Ann Fisher special. The Supreme Court upholds most of President Obama's Affordable Health Care Act. The Supreme Court has upheld the individual insurance requirement at the heart of President Barack Obama's health care overhaul. In a 5-4 ruling, the court this morning rejected that Congress went too far in requiring most Americans to have health insurance or pay a penalty. We're waiting for remarks by President Obama. When that happens, we'll bring it to you live. Coming up, Maurice Thompson. He's executive director of the 1851 Center for Constitutional Law. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
More than 2 years after President Obama signed his health care law, the Supreme Court weighs in with a ruling that could reshape the health care industry, change the way you get and pay for medical care, and shake up the presidential campaign. I'm Neil Conan. The final ruling on the health care law and what it means for you. Join us next Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
Talk of the Nation is this afternoon from 2 until 4, and continuing coverage of the health care decision from the U.S. Supreme Court here on 89.7 NPR News. Stay with us for more All Sides with Ann Fisher from now until 1 o'clock this afternoon, and then we will have On Point and then Talk of the Nation as our special coverage continues. 85 degrees in downtown Columbus, sunny and hot today, a high reaching 100 degrees, partly cloudy for tonight, a low of 75. Sunshine with a chance of showers and thunderstorms on Friday, a high of 95 degrees. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues. This is 89.7 NPR News.
You're listening to an All Sides with Ann Fisher special. The Supreme Court upholds most of President Obama's Affordable Health Care Act. The Supreme Court has upheld the individual insurance requirement at the heart of President Barack Obama's health care overhaul. In a 5-4 ruling, the court this morning rejected that Congress went too far in requiring most Americans to have health insurance or pay a penalty. We're waiting for remarks by President Obama and the Speaker of the House, John Boehner. When that happens, we'll bring either or to you live, if they're available live. Joining us now, Maurice Thompson, Executive Director of the 1851 Center for Constitutional Law. Welcome back to the show, Maurice.
Hi, Ann.
So I imagine that you're disappointed by the ruling today. You opposed the law in the first place.
Sure. We did oppose the law on philosophical grounds as well as constitutional grounds. So disappointed is true. I think that your first reaction is always to be angry at something like this. I think first gut reaction of most conservatives and libertarians and even independents who are upset about the law is kind of a very negative reaction towards Justice John Roberts and the man who appointed him, George Bush. You know, there's definitely a feeling of betrayal there. As, of course, Bush betrayed limited government principles time and time again while he was in office, but this is just sort of the icing on the cake, and the notion that compromising your principles continues to pay negative dividends, you know, even 4 years after he's out of office.
Are you surprised by Justice Roberts' position on this or not? Some people are.
Well, I think that the common conventional wisdom, which is, you know, conventional wisdom is usually wrong, of course, was that Justice Kennedy would be the swing vote here, if anybody. And so all of the briefs, including our amicus brief, were really targeted towards convincing Justice Kennedy and maybe Scalia. We thought we'd have a bigger problem with him, perhaps. So all this effort and this attention was paid to how they think, and really, I think very little attention by the opponents of the mandate was paid to how Justice Roberts may think, and particularly to this tax issue. You know, if you notice in the decision, the court actually agrees with us on the proposition that the Commerce Clause and Necessary and Proper Clause don't allow for this mandate, and that's what all the huffing and puffing was about, and that's what all of our arguments were about. And here this tax issue slid under the radar. And I think it was under the radar rightfully so. You know, the Supreme Court has said in the past a tax is defined as a pecuniary burden laid upon individuals or property for the purpose of supporting the government. And I don't think that anybody seriously believes, even after this decision, that the purpose of the mandate is to support the federal government or to reimburse them for some cost that they experience. Nobody has argued that at any point. And in fact, President Obama said repeatedly, this is not a tax. I'm not imposing a tax on the poor or on the middle class person who does not have health insurance. So I think it's quite shocking, both in light of law and policy and political rhetoric, that this is upheld as a tax.
Peter Shane, do you agree?
I think people across the political spectrum will be surprised that the court relied on the taxing power, and especially because, again, without having read the entire opinion, there was a peculiar procedural problem in the case, which is if the court regarded this as a tax under something called the Anti-Injunction Act, then it shouldn't have been decided now. Judge Brett Kavanaugh in the D.C. Circuit said he was a very, really a brilliant analyst, very good conservative judge on the D.C. Circuit, said this was a premature decision because under the Anti-Injunction Act, this should be regarded as a tax, and people can't challenge taxes until they're actually levied, which has not yet happened. The court here, in Chief Justice Roberts' opinion, said, well, the statute calls it a penalty, not a tax. And my understanding of a tax is the same as your other guest. And so the Anti-Injunction Act doesn't apply. But the fact that it's not called a tax doesn't mean that Congress can't uphold it under the taxing power. I think from left to right in the Supreme Court watching community, there'll be a lot of head scratching over the outcome.
Ruth Kolker?
Yeah, I agree with Peter, just to make this a little bit more clear, the Anti-Injunction Act is a statute, And so it says that if something is considered to be a tax, that you can't seek injunctive relief before it goes into effect. So what the court has told us is that as a matter of statutory interpretation, interpreting what Congress meant when it passed the Anti-Injunction Act, I believe in the 19th century, what did the word tax mean? And because the word tax wasn't used in this statute, Congress then didn't intend as a statutory matter for the Anti-Injunction Act to apply to the statute that Congress also passed. Congress passed the Anti-Injunction Act, the previous Congress, obviously, and Congress passed this statute. Then there's a second question of what does the taxing power mean under the Constitution? And so the court is telling us, Chief Justice Roberts is telling us, I think he's the only one that splits it this way, but Chief Justice Roberts is telling us that merely because the word tax, as it's used in the Anti-Injunction Act, doesn't apply to the statute, it doesn't mean that Congress can't be relying on its taxing power as the word taxing power is understood under the Constitution. So it's odd that Congress under the Constitution can proceed under the taxing power, but that doesn't mean it proceeded under as a tax for the purposes of the Anti-Injunction Act. I think that's a very surprising outcome. It is one that was briefed. You find that argument in the briefs filed by the Obama administration. I think people will now go more closely and look at how that argument was parsed because it is the one that the court, Chief Justice Roberts, has accepted.
Peter?
Can I just say one word of consolation to my more conservative friends who might feel betrayed this morning by Chief Justice Roberts? I think institutionally, the stance that the Chief Justice took was brilliant from a conservative jurist's point of view. Chief Justice Roberts has a very conservative view of constitutional law. He is also very protective of the institutional stature and prerogatives of the Supreme Court. By writing the opinion that he wrote, he was able to avoid the charge that the court was simply invalidating laws that it didn't like. In fact, he was allowing, he was exercising judicial restraint by allowing a legal controversy that is quite obviously in front of the electorate to be decided by the electorate. So he avoids being tagged as a judicial activist in that sense. Meanwhile, he gets to basically write a free opinion on what the Commerce Clause means. So we now have five justices agreeing that the Commerce Clause would not have provided sufficient support for the law. And he gets the votes of Justices Breyer and Kagan on restricting Congress's power to basically compel the states to participate in federal programs by giving them offers that they cannot refuse. So if you're looking at this in terms of the long-term development of the law, it's hard to see how the Chief Justice could have done more to both advance a conservative view of the Constitution and preserve the popular sense of legitimacy in the Supreme Court.
Maurice Thompson, going forward, what's the plan? What are your expectations about what you'll be doing?
Well, you know, we've tried to you can't possibly downplay the importance of this day and this decision. You know, obviously it's a historic ruling. Not as historic as it could have been, but while we've been acknowledging that, at the same time, previously I think also on your show I've acknowledged that this is, you know, at least a two-humped camel, and if the court were to uphold the act, it would unleash a flurry of additional litigation, and that is going to be the case. So here in Ohio, the game plan is twofold. We do have this Health Care Freedom Amendment, which purports to provide a state constitutional liberty protecting people from being forced to buy insurance. And what we have is the federal government saying that the federal government has the power to tax this behavior. But what we don't have is the Supreme Court saying that citizens might have, nevertheless, a right to be free from it under substantive due process. So what we'll look at is a substantive due process case arguing that Ohioans have a fundamental liberty interest to be free from purchasing insurance. And also in the interim, between now and November, we'll do everything we can to stop the state government from enacting an Obamacare exchange, which really is kind of the last blow and would put this thing in full motion, even if there were to be a Romney presidency that perhaps would suspend these laws somehow, which frankly is going to be tough to do. But we think that we need to at least stop these wheels from turning in state government between now and November. After that, it's a crapshoot.
Maurice, thank you so much for joining us today. We really appreciate it.
Thank you.
It's Maurice Thompson. He's executive director of the 1851 Center for Constitutional Law. Coming up, we're going to talk with Kathy Levine. She's the executive director of UCAN Ohio. I want to let people know, if you're just joining us, you're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. The Supreme Court upholds most of President Obama's Affordable Health Care Act. The Supreme Court has upheld the individual insurance requirement at the heart of the president's health care overhaul. In a 5-4 ruling, the court this morning rejected that Congress went too far in requiring most Americans to have health insurance or pay a penalty. We're waiting for remarks by President Obama. When that happens, we'll bring it to you live. Also with us today, Peter Shane, the Jacob E. Davis and Jacob E. Davis II Chair in Law at The Ohio State University Moritz College of Law, and also his colleague Ruth Kolker, constitutional law professor at Moritz as well. Joining us now, Kathy Levine, executive director of UCAN Ohio. Kathy, welcome back to the show.
Oh, thank you, Ann. It's a great day for Ohioans.
Tell me, were you expecting it? Are you surprised? What's your take on that?
I'm relieved. I'm very relieved. It's a great day to celebrate. I mean, you know, this lifts the cloud that's been hanging over implementing the law.
Does it lift all the clouds, Ruth Kolker? What do you think about that? Is it that clear?
Well, what's clear is that the law, in part, is constitutional. The individual mandate is constitutional, but we have a lot of fighting ahead of us. The states are required to create these insurance exchanges. Ohio, like many other states, have not chosen to take that step. That now becomes a supremacy clause problem. I'm sure there's going to be litigation about some states' disinclination to create these insurance exchanges. There's going to be... When this law does go into effect, there will be, as a previous guest mentioned, there'll be some liberty challenges to this as an individual rights issue. I wouldn't expect that to be successful under the court's current liberty jurisprudence, but you never know where things will go. So this is not going to be the last piece of litigation on this matter. However, I guess it is now more likely than not that the law will go into effect as implemented, because I don't see political developments in Congress resulting in this law being repealed, irrespective of who becomes president in November.
Well, but as a practical matter, the Affordable Care Act doesn't require any state to create an exchange, but we have not come across any elected official in Ohio who thinks that if the law is the law of the land, we're better off having the federal government run an exchange for us.
Which would be the alternative if the state doesn't go forward and develop its own, right?
Yes, everybody agrees we're better off creating our own marketplace for health care that meets the needs of Ohioans. And it's time to put the partisan bickering aside and to get to work on planning for how to create a marketplace for insurance that works for Ohioans.
Ohio hasn't, as far as we know, gotten started in that process. Lieutenant Governor Mary Taylor is also director of the Department of Insurance, and hopefully we'll have her on the show later on today. But as far as we know, there hasn't been any effort made to do that. Are we too far behind the eight ball, Kathy, or is there still time?
Well, I think it's going to be hard for us to get something up and running by January 1 of 2014, but if we start working and playing catch up today, we can work, first of all, do a partnership exchange with the federal government initially, and then move to our own state-operated exchange. Regardless of whether the federal government operates it, we do a partnership, or we build our own exchange. Ohioans want to be involved in planning to make sure that it meets the needs of Ohioans. Representative John Carney, who's a member of the minority party, introduced exchange legislation and has been holding multiple stakeholder meetings. So there are, and the Health Policy Institute of Ohio has been hosting conversations. So we're not starting from the total beginning. If our elected officials aren't all engaged in this, the healthcare stakeholders, the insurance companies, the insurance agents, consumers, providers, you know, managed care plans, they've all been at the table having conversations. So we're not starting from nowhere, but we have a huge amount of catch-up to do.
Peter Shane?
I just wanted to add that, you know, now that the opinion has been rendered, it is worth remembering that the basic policy structure of the Affordable Care Act started as a set of propositions from basically free market-oriented and conservative think tanks about how to provide universal coverage while being deferential to the free market and to local control. And so for all of the rhetoric about this being a government takeover, it is very much intended, and whether this is good policy or not, people may debate, but this is very much intended to be market-driven reform.
Absolutely, yeah.
And the only other thing I would add is that as we get closer to 2014 and people begin to see the practical benefits to them of the law, I mean, I think one of the political consequences of the delayed implementation is that this is just an abstraction to a lot of people, except, of course, the people who are already protected by those provisions that are already in effect.
Pre-existing conditions, kids who can be on their parents' health insurance until the age of 26, that...
Right.
Yeah.
But no state, if these exchanges are successful, for example, in lowering costs for small businesses, you know, what state wants to be in the position of saying to potential business creators, come to our state and we won't help you lower your health care costs?
Ohio medical professionals are weighing in on the Supreme Court's decision to uphold the heart of President Obama's health care law. The head of the Ohio State Medical Association says his group remains committed to effectively reforming an unsustainable health care delivery system. Dr. Deepak Kumar calls on Congress to improve what he calls several deficiencies in the law by eliminating the current formula of caps on Medicaid payments to doctors and hospitals. Any response to that, Kathy Levine? Agree?
I'm not going to weigh into the medical association's issues. Today is the day to celebrate that Ohioans are looking to a time when nobody has to go broke just because they get sick. You know, as Professor Shane just said, we're going to have a marketplace where people go and get, you know, assistance in paying for health coverage. We have consumer protections against being, you know, clobbered by insurance companies because you have a pre-existing condition.
What about
the Ohio State Medical Association should be elated that this law was upheld.
What about the issue of the Medicaid expansion?
Well, it sounds like the courts gave wiggle room to states, but what state is going to refuse to take federal money to do the Medicaid expansion? I mean, the Kasich administration has done a tremendous amount of planning for the Medicaid expansion. I can't imagine they'd back off now.
Okay. Well, Kathy Levine, thanks so much for joining us today.
Sure. Thank you.
You are listening to a special edition of All Sides with Ann Fisher. The individual mandate survives. The Supreme Court has upheld most of the heart of President Barack Obama's health care overhaul, ruling in favor of the requirement that most Americans be required to have health insurance or else pay a penalty. Coming up, we're still waiting to hear from the President of the United States and get his reaction to it. If and when that airs live on NPR, we will bring it to you as well. Right now, we are still talking with Ruth Kolker, constitutional law professor at Ohio State University Moritz College of Law. Also, Peter Shane, her colleague there. When we return, we'll move on. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
This is 89.7 NPR News. And stay with All Sides with Ann Fisher for continuing coverage of the Supreme Court's decision. We will also bring you On Point with coverage at 1 o'clock and Talk of the Nation with live coverage from 2 until 4. This is 89.7 NPR News.
Support for 89.7 comes from the Lancaster Festival, beginning a day early this year to welcome renowned pianist Misha Dichter in concert with the Lancaster Festival Orchestra on Wednesday, July 18th at 7:30. Details at lancasterfestival.org.
If you contributed to 89.7 NPR News this year, thank you. Your support provides for the highest quality news and information. Our fiscal year ends on June 30th, and we're close to our goal, but we still need to hear from you. If you wish to make an additional gift or fulfill your current gift, you can do so at WOSU.org. Thank you for supporting 89.7 NPR News. It's 89 degrees in downtown Columbus, sunny and hot today with a high of 100. Partly cloudy tonight, a low of 75. Mostly sunny for Friday, there is a chance of a shower or thunderstorm in the afternoon, a high of 95 degrees. Special coverage from All Sides with Ann Fisher continues. This is 89.7 NPR News.
You're listening to an All Sides with Ann Fisher special. The Supreme Court upholds most of President Obama's Affordable Health Care Act. The Supreme Court has upheld the individual insurance requirement at the heart of the president's health care overhaul. In a 5-4 ruling, the court this morning rejected that Congress went too far in requiring most Americans to have health insurance or pay a penalty. Justices who voted for health care, Chief Justice John Roberts, Sonia Sotomayor, Elena Kagan, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, and Stephen Breyer. Those who voted against, Justices Anthony Kennedy, Antonin Scalia, Clarence Thomas, and Samuel Alito. If you have a question or comment for our guests, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. We are waiting for comments, remarks by President Obama. When that happens, we'll bring it to you live, and we may or may not get to some comments from some others, including House Speaker John Boehner, of course, a Republican from Ohio, and GOP presidential candidate Mitt Romney. Once again, questions or comments for our guests right now, Peter Shane and Ruth Kolker, both professors at Ohio State University Moritz College of Law, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. The court found problems with the law's expansion of Medicaid, but even there, it said the expansion could proceed as long as the federal government does not threaten to withhold the entire Medicaid allotment to states if they don't take part in the extension. The court's four liberal justices, once again, Stephen Breyer, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, Elena Kagan, and Sonia Sotomayor, joined Chief Justice Roberts in the outcome. Ruth Kolker, what do we wait and see happens now? What next turn of events at this point?
Well, it'll be interesting to hear from the 26 state attorney generals and governors who opposed the health care law and were seeking to have the court overturn it. What are they going to do next? Are they going to pursue other litigation routes to try to find other ways to not have to implement this law at the state level? Are they now going to say we respect the judgment of the Supreme Court and we will now act in a cooperative way until Congress might choose at a later time to overturn this decision? And of course, the Medicaid ruling gives states an enormous set of very difficult choices to make. And now we'll have to hear from each of the 50 state governors as to what choice they want to make with respect to Medicaid expansion. It puts the ball back in their court.
Peter?
I think I agree with what Ruth just said. The one thing I would add, and maybe what many people will find most frustrating, is that the Affordable Care Act by no means purports to be the last word on cost control in healthcare delivery in the United States. The Congressional Budget Office projection suggests that the act will have a very important positive effect on reducing the growth of the deficit. But and I'm not a healthcare finance expert by any means. My understanding is that the projections of the current system still look towards a level of GDP going to healthcare that is not sustainable over the long term, and whether this Congress can manage to consensus around any kind of additional program or policy framework to control costs, I don't see how that's going to happen. And yet, if it doesn't happen, the problems of overall burden to the economy are not going to go away.
Joe in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Joe.
Hey, I wonder if you can, your guest can clarify who is covered under Medicaid under the new law and who has to buy insurance but is given a subsidy to pay for it.
Well, that's the question that's up in the air right now, right, Ruth Kolker? I mean, depends on how the states decide to do it.
Well, he asked two separate questions. He asked if the states do choose to opt into Medicaid, what does that mean for an individual? How do you know whether you're poor enough to be covered? And then the second question was, even though some people, let's say a state opts in, even though some people might not be poor enough to be covered by Medicaid, they're still poor enough, if that's the right word, to not be subject to the individual mandate. And so it's not that every American is subject to the individual mandate. There's an income threshold, and I don't happen to know the specific facts of what that income threshold is. So if you're an individual who's living at the margins and you want to know whether this decision affects you, the two things you'll have to know is what is your state going to do in terms of Medicaid expansion? Is it going to maybe choose to expand Medicaid in a way that will now cause you to be covered? And if your state chooses or doesn't choose Medicaid expansion but still leaves you out of luck, are you someone who will be getting a subsidy from the federal government or exempted in some way from the individual mandate? And of course, another piece of this legislation, I'm not an expert in healthcare law, I believe another piece is to require employers, if they have a certain number of employees, to now offer health insurance. And so some people may find themselves that they have a choice now to purchase health insurance from their employer, that was not a choice they previously had. None of these things are going to be implemented tomorrow. The statute doesn't go into effect in many parts until January 1st of 2014. But those are some of the questions that one might want to ask to figure out how this might affect them individually.
One thing I would—
Peter Shane, yeah.
Yeah. One thing I would just add to that is that the Department of Health and Human Services, that is the U.S. Department, has been already, I think, moving pretty aggressively and is undoubtedly going to move more aggressively to get information online to people about what their healthcare options are and answer the very kind of question that the caller was asking. I have not looked at hhs.gov lately, but my guess is that a lot of the answers are there and are more likely to be there in the coming months.
Ruth?
And another important place people will look, not immediately, but in the coming months, will be their own state website. If a state does choose to join an insurance exchange, like Massachusetts has an insurance exchange under their own state healthcare law, you will most likely be able to go to a state resource and find out what are those insurance exchanges in your state, what would it cost you as an individual to buy insurance through the insurance exchange. So people will also at some future date probably want to go to some website in their home state to find out now what new choices are available to them that weren't available before.
Thanks to Joe for that call. We appreciate it. Yvette and Gahanna, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Yvette.
Thank you for taking my call. I am actually in Ohio, and I fall into the situation where I make just about $150, almost $200 over the limit for being able to qualify for Medicaid. And I have a daughter that has multiple disabilities and requires a lot of health care and a lot of expensive medication, including asthma medication. If you have kids that have asthma, you know how expensive that those medications are. Mm-hmm. I wanted to just mention that as soon as I heard that the health care law was upheld by the court, I immediately, once I heard also that individual states had the opportunity to reject the additional funds so as to not increase the role of Medicaid recipients mm-hmm. in their state, I immediately contacted our governor, Governor Kasich, and left a message to ask him to please accept those funds, because there will still be a lot of people who fall into my situation where we make just a little too much to qualify and desperately need the health care for, like, our children. And I just have one child, but to not reject those funds because people desperately need them. And although, you know, the court did uphold the law, I just hope that the states don't reject those additional funds and leave a lot of people out.
Because
and I wondered if
Go ahead, Yvette.
I wondered if you knew anything specifically about Ohio's maybe buy-in program, or if they have any plans to reject that.
We don't know that. We're hoping to find out more about that later today. I have no idea whether they're going to come to any kind of conclusive decision today or not. The state is. They have plenty of time to make a decision, actually. The law doesn't go into effect until for about a year and a half, the full measure of the law. But there are going to be people that fall through the cracks. They may not be paying a fine for not getting health insurance, but they won't qualify at the Medicaid level to one degree or another, depending on what state they live in and depending on what the states decide. And it sounds like, Yvette, you could fall through that crack, and you're one of those the candidate for that.
I think I would fall through if our state rejected the additional funds to increase the role, because that would increase the limit. Even if they increased it just a little bit, you know, I would be covered for my child. But if they rejected those funds, then I would be one of those thousands of people that would fall through the cracks. And I just urge anybody else that may be in my situation to call Governor Kasich to urge him to accept the funds.
All right, Yvette, thanks for your call. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
The Supreme Court has upheld the heart of President Barack Obama's health care overhaul, ruling in favor of the requirement that most Americans can be required to have health insurance or else pay a penalty. If you're just joining us, you're listening to an All Sides with Dan Fisher special. The Supreme Court, once again, has upheld the individual insurance requirement at the heart of the president's health care overhaul. In a 5-4 ruling, the court this morning rejected the Congress. Congress went too far in requiring most Americans to have health insurance or pay a penalty. We're waiting for remarks from by President Barack Obama. When that happens, we'll bring it to you live. We're waiting to see if there are going to be any other live coverage that we can get regarding this at the national level. We will bring to you. If you have a question or comment for us, 614-292-8513. Or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. Joining us now, still with us, Peter Shane, professor of law at The Ohio State University Moritz College of Law. Also, Ruth Kolker, his colleague at The Ohio State University Moritz College of Law. Coming up, we're going to talk some more about politics. But in the meantime, is the Medicaid expansion the only big question at this point that they've left?
Well,
Peter,
one of your guests we spoke to by phone earlier mentioned that there was going to be litigation.
Okay, we are going to after the courts. Okay, going to Mitt Romney, former governor Mitt Romney. He's speaking now from Washington.
That Obamacare is good law, or that it's good policy. Obamacare was bad policy yesterday. It's bad policy today. Obamacare was bad law yesterday. It's bad law today. Let me tell you why I say that. Obamacare raises taxes on the American people by approximately $500 billion. Obamacare cuts Medicare by approximately $500 billion. And even with those cuts and tax increases, Obamacare adds trillions to our deficits and to our national debt and pushes those obligations on to coming generations. Obamacare also means that for up to 20 million Americans, they will lose the insurance they currently have, the insurance that they like and they want to keep. Obamacare is a job killer. Businesses across the country have been asked what the impact is of Obamacare. 3/4 of those surveyed by the Chamber of Commerce said Obamacare makes it less likely for them to hire people. And perhaps most troubling of all, Obamacare puts the federal government between you and your doctor. For all those reasons, it's important for us to repeal and replace Obamacare. What are some of the things that we'll keep in place and must be in place in a reform, a real reform of our healthcare system? One, we have to make sure that people who want to keep their current insurance will be able to do so. Having 20 million people, up to that number of people, lose the insurance they want is simply unacceptable. Number two, got to make sure that those people who have pre-existing conditions know that they will be able to be insured and they will not lose their insurance. We also have to assure that we do our very best to help each state in their effort to assure that every American has access to affordable health care. And something that Obamacare does not do that must be done in real reform is helping lower the cost of health care and health insurance. It's becoming prohibitively expensive. And so this is now a time for the American people to make a choice. You can choose whether you want to have a larger and larger government, more and more intrusive in your life, separating you and your doctor, whether you're comfortable with more deficits, higher debt that we pass on to the coming generations, whether you're willing to have the government put in place a plan that potentially causes you to lose the insurance that you like, or whether instead you want to return to a time when the American people will have their own choice in health care, where consumers will be able to make their choices as to what kind of health insurance they want. This is a time of choice for the American people. Our mission is clear. If we want to get rid of Obamacare, we're going to have to replace President Obama. My mission is to make sure we do exactly that, that we return to the American people the privilege they've always had to live their lives in the way they feel most appropriate, where we don't pass on to coming generations massive deficits and debt, where we don't have a setting where jobs are lost. If we want good jobs and a bright economic future for ourselves and for our kids, we must replace Obamacare. That is my mission, that is our work, and I'm asking the people of America to join me. If you don't want the course that President Obama has put us on, if you want instead a course that the founders envisioned, then join me in this effort. Help us. Help us defeat Obamacare. Help us defeat the liberal agenda that makes government too big, too intrusive, and that's killing jobs across this great country. Thank you so much.
That's GOP presidential candidate Mitt Romney. He's calling for the repeal of the law. The former Massachusetts Governor Romney was speaking from Washington. His podium from which he spoke had a big banner in front of it. It said repeal and replace. Just very quickly, Ruth Kolker, let's go over the idea of the repeal and replace. What are the chances of that?
Pretty low. So the current Congress still could, as it could yesterday, vote to repeal this statute. But to do so would have to get past the United States Senate, and the Democrats could easily filibuster to prevent that vote. But even if they chose not to filibuster and prevent that vote, even assuming the United States Senate as well as the House voted to repeal, President Obama would certainly veto such a measure, and there's no way there's a two-thirds majority of the United States Senate to override President Obama's veto. If we have a new president sworn into office in January, and the new president would choose to agree to sign such a repeal into law, it still has to get through Congress for him to sign it into law, and the filibuster would still be present. Of course, it's possible the Republicans will win a supermajority of the United States Senate, as well as Romney becoming the next president, but that's what it would take for the Republicans to be able to repeal it. And I think that most people are not anticipating that kind of sweeping a landslide election in the United States Senate to make such a repeal possible.
Peter Shane, anything to add to that?
I agree, and I would just urge Governor Romney to recall that President Clinton promised that on the first day of his administration in 1992, he would allow gays and lesbians to serve in the armed forces without restriction. On the first day of President Obama's administration, he was going to close Guantanamo. There are two branches of government that are elected, and without the cooperation of the legislative branch, the president's capacity to change the law is extremely limited.
You're listening to Peter Shane. He's the Jacob E. Davis and Jacob E. Davis II Chair in Law at The Ohio State University Moritz College of Law. I want to say thanks to Ruth Kolker, Constitutional Law Professor at The Ohio State University Moritz College of Law. Thanks so much for joining us today, Ruth.
It's been my pleasure, Ann. Thank you.
If you have any questions or comments, 614-292-8513. You can also email us at allsides@wosu.org. We just heard from GOP presidential candidate Mitt Romney calling for the repeal of the law. Former Massachusetts Governor Romney, he was speaking from Washington. His podium had a banner in front of it. It said repeal and replace. Coming up later, we'll hear from more local political public affairs reporters and others. This is a special edition of All Sides with Dan Fisher. The individual mandate survives. The Supreme Court has upheld the heart of President Barack Obama's health care overhaul, ruling in favor of the requirement that most Americans can be required to have health insurance or else pay a penalty. The decision means the historic overhaul will continue to take effect over the next several years. affecting the way countless Americans receive and pay for their personal medical care. The ruling also hands President Barack Obama a campaign season victory. Coming up, complete analysis of the landmark decision, what it means for the nation's and state's healthcare industry. It's coming up after the news on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 FM and streaming online at WOSU.org. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher. This is WOSU 89.7 and WOSU HD1 Columbus. Streaming online at WOSU.org. 89.7 NPR News, a service of WOSU Public Media.